Dublin. I'm on the faculty at the School of Social Work and the Graduate School of Public Health. And it's my pleasure today to introduce Dr. Nicholas Fortenberg. Dr. Fortenberg is a professor and director of programs in urban health at Hunter College, City University of New York. He's worked with many community groups in New York and elsewhere to develop, implement, and evaluate programs to reduce HIV, substance abuse, and violence. Today, he will speak with us on strategies for improving the health of urban populations. Dr. Fortenberg will talk for about 30 minutes, and then we will have each panelist introduce themselves and talk with us, and then later we will open it up for questions. And I would ask the panelists and Dr. Fortenberg to be cognizant of the time constraints today.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here. You know, in New York, when we face time constraints, what we do is talk faster rather than say less. So if I get a little ahead of myself, tell me to slow down, and I will say a little bit less, too. Throughout human history, cities have played two roles in public health. On the one hand, they've been factories for ill health, concentrating people in crowded and polluted environments, pulling people from villages, farms, and the countryside, thereby depriving them of healthy food and safe shelter, disrupting established social networks that have supported health, and jeopardizing the social cohesion that enforces healthful behavior. On the other hand, however, cities are the birthplace of modern public health, and perhaps social democracy and justice as well. Urban wealth provides the resources needed to create clean water supplies, establish sanitary processes, establish a more diverse and stable diet, and construct healthcare facilities. Population density allows the social mobilizations that have led to reform movements, both here in the United States and elsewhere, that have led to improved living conditions in cities. And the interdependence of urban populations requires a more collective consciousness, perhaps, than rural areas. In the United States today, cities also play a dual role. Nowhere in this nation are health disparities more pronounced than in cities. In my own city, New York, we have both the poorest congressional district in the nation, Mott Haven in the South Bronx, and half the world's billionaires have homes in New York City. Yet urban areas also have the financial, human, and social capital that's needed to reduce gaps in health and in living conditions. But if the United States is to achieve the goals laid out in Healthy People 2010, it will need to find new ways to promote health and prevent disease in central cities. It'll especially need to find ways to better protect the health of 10 million people or so who live in high poverty neighborhoods, primarily African American and Latino, concentrated in our central cities. In my talk today, I'll suggest some directions for research and practice that can help us understand better the role of cities in producing and nurturing health disparities, and also help us to develop and evaluate interventions that can reduce these disparities. Although researchers have focused more on ethnicity, class, and race than on urban residents as a cause of health and disease, it is generally agreed that a significant number of health conditions are more common in cities than in non-urban areas. For example, HIV infection, tuberculosis, homicide, asthma, lead poisoning, as well as preterm delivery, heart disease, stroke, certain kinds of cancers, are more common in cities. Moreover, certain subpopulations of cities, those living in concentrated poverty, have experienced staggeringly high and increasing rates of illness and death in recent decades. Their health status has been unfavorably compared to that of many developing countries. The urban health penalty has two related but distinct causes. First, cities concentrate poor people, African Americans and Latinos, recent immigrants, children, and other vulnerable populations. A substantial portion of the excess burden of ill health in cities can be attributed to the populations that social forces such as suburbanization, urban renewal, immigration, and segregation have sorted into central cities. The second cause is the urban environment. Cities, and especially poor neighborhoods in cities, have higher levels of certain pollutants, more deteriorated and overcrowded housing, higher rates of crime and other stressful social conditions, lower quality schools and other public facilities, and, in some cases, less access to adequately paid entry-level jobs. These characteristics of the physical and social environments of cities have important influences on health. An important research task is to understand the role that these demographic and environmental factors play in maintaining health disparities, and how these two interact with each other to produce ill health. It's also worth noting that in the last 10 years or so, the distinction between central cities and suburbs has diminished. We've seen the growth of edge cities, minority suburbs, poverty suburbs, especially those immediately adjoining central cities. And we've also seen the migration of health conditions such as HIV infection, substance abuse, violence, conditions previously regarded as primarily urban into suburban and rural areas. While we'll need to develop national strategies to address suburban and rural health problems, the migration of urban problems into other areas also emphasizes the importance of dealing with our problems in the city before they spread elsewhere. The primary goal of my talk today is to suggest some directions for research that can help us understand the causes and then reduce the health disparities, both within cities and between urban and non-urban areas. And I'll discuss four interrelated lines of research. The first seeks to understand the forces that move populations into vulnerability. The second seeks to identify the social processes that sustain and magnify health disparities within U.S. cities. The third looks for ways to synthesize in new ways our understanding of interventions in order to guide future practice. And the final looks at how to develop and evaluate interventions to reduce disparities. My thoughts on urban health have been shaped by New York City's experience in the last quarter century, which in some ways is similar to other cities and in some ways different. During that period, slowing and in some cases reversing more than a century of public health progress, the HIV epidemic hit New York City, devastating two populations, injecting drug users and their partners, and men who have sex with men. In addition, the city experienced a resurgence of tuberculosis, and in the mid-1980s, epidemics of sexually transmitted diseases, both syphilis and gonorrhea. Congenital syphilis, a condition that most physicians had not seen for decades, reemerged in New York City in the 1980s, and it was again a common occurrence in the city's public obstetric and neonatal units. The period also saw the crack epidemic, which contributed both to increases in infectious diseases and to a dramatic deterioration in family life in many inner city neighborhoods. Homicides also rose significantly, in part in tandem with the drug trade and also because of the increased availability of guns. For a young public health researcher, these events in the late 70s and early 80s challenged the prevailing belief that in the United States we could expect steady public health progress and the eventual elimination of both infectious and poverty-related diseases. And at least for me, and I think for many others, that experience led us to a determination among public health researchers that never again would we stand by and look at policies that move people into illness and death and not speak out and do everything we could to change those conditions. It demonstrated the heavy price to be paid for the lack of public health vigilance and for losing sight of the role of social conditions in shaping patterns of disease. New York City's public health crises of the late 20th century had multiple causes, but a determining factor was the rapid growth in vulnerable populations. And if you could move to the overhead projector. And I just quickly want to show you a few overheads that come from work a colleague of mine, an infectious epidemiologist, and I are doing to look at changes in vulnerable populations in New York City. This shows children living in poverty between 1975 and 1995. Next one. immigrants admitted to New York City in that same time period. Next one. People in jail. Look at that increase from 1980 to 1990. Next one. These are estimates of drug injectors in New York City. Again, an incredibly steep rise. Estimates of the number of homeless people in New York City. So in that very time period that we saw a resurgence of a variety of conditions, we saw dramatic increases in several vulnerable populations. And if you could show the next one. This shows you jail population together with drug users and diagnosed cases of AIDS. Next one. Increase in asthma in children and children living in poverty. And I'm not trying to make a simple point that these things are directly causally related, but we would be foolish not to look at the demographic changes and their relationship to the health changes. Next one. And this shows tuberculosis among people coming from other countries and immigration. As the U.S. Thanks, that's all for now. As the U.S. economy again slows down, we need to ask, who are the vulnerable populations in the early 21st century, and what are the social forces that will lead to their growth or decline? If we could see the next one there. Some possible candidates include those who are reaching welfare term limits and are not yet or no longer employed. Recent immigrants coming to the United States from high poverty areas, the more than 1 million people each year who return to their communities from jail or prison, and children brought up in extreme poverty. Each of these groups is disproportionately located in urban areas. To look just at one of those, people leaving welfare, illustrates their potential to contribute to disparities in the future. Between 1994 and 1999, more than 1 million U.S. children left welfare. While about 60% of welfare leavers are currently working, that means 40% aren't, only about 40% of those who are working work consistently throughout the year. A Wisconsin study of welfare leavers that followed them for 3 years found that for those with earned income, median income, family income at the end of the 3 years was still substantially below the federal poverty level. Several national studies have shown that many people leaving welfare have also lost Medicaid coverage and food stamps, despite Congress's mandate not to link these two programs. In a national study conducted by the Urban Institute, 33% of welfare leavers reported that they had to cut the size of meals or skip them entirely because there wasn't enough money for food. 39% reported that at some time in the last year they'd been unable to pay rent, mortgage, or utilities, and 7% had to move in with others because they couldn't afford housing. These data suggest that we may see emerging illness in at least some portion of those leaving welfare, especially if our economy goes into recession. Unfortunately, few welfare researchers are studying the health consequences of these policy changes, and an urgent task for public health researchers is to begin to assemble the information we do have on the health consequences of so-called welfare reform so that we can participate in next year's debates on reauthorization of the Personal Responsibility Work Opportunity and Reconciliation Act. Next slide. More broadly, among the research questions we need to ask about vulnerable populations are what proportion of morbidity and mortality these vulnerable populations account for, and what is their burden of excess illness and death? Two, what are the social, psychological, and physiological pathways by which vulnerability is converted into adverse health outcomes? To what extent and under what conditions do health problems concentrated in vulnerable populations spread to other sectors of the population? If we understand that, we can make the political case for national social action. Unfortunately, people aren't moved alone by public health or moral or social justice arguments. What individual characteristics and social policies protect vulnerable populations? And what health promotion strategies can build resilience among vulnerable populations? If you could go on to the next one. Traditional public health strategies use surveillance to identify specific disease outbreaks. Another approach would be to monitor the living conditions of vulnerable populations, taking action to reduce vulnerability when warning signs appear. And as researchers, we need to be developing the science base that would allow us to evaluate that strategy and compare it to more traditional ones. The second line of research I wanted to recommend was to study the social processes that magnify disparities. This approach begins with the acknowledgement that disparities already exist. It seeks to identify the characteristics of urban life that perpetuate or even exacerbate these disparities, and then to develop interventions to change these specific processes while we wait and advocate for more fundamental social reforms. Let me give a few examples. Next slide. The lack of affordable and quality child care in low-income urban communities adversely affects health in several ways. It keeps some parents, especially mothers and single mothers, from working, thus reducing their income. A robust body of literature suggests that high-quality child care prepares children for educational success, supports cognitive development, and teaches important social skills. Good child care includes health promotion and nutrition services and helps link kids and families to primary health care. Depriving poor children of these benefits puts them at greater disadvantage in later years. Parents who are forced to choose inadequate daycare have the added stress about worrying about their children's well-being when they're at work, thus endangering their own health. They may also need to take time off from work for emergencies or to care for children when they're at risk, thus risking their employment status. Operating through several different pathways, lack of quality child care magnifies the health disparities that characterize low-income communities and obviously suggests an intervention point. The quality of primary and secondary education also influences disparity in health. Level of education is one of the most consistent predictors of good health and longevity, and yet low-income communities, African-American and Latino communities, have the worst elementary and secondary schools in the nation. A third example of a social process that magnifies disparities is our nation's process of returning inmates leaving jail and prisons to their communities. Because my own work is focused on this area, I want to spend a little time examining the disparity-enhancing aspects of this particular social process. About 2 million Americans are behind bars on any given day, and last year, 600,000 inmates were released from state and federal prisons, a 353% increase from 1980. Each year, 10 million people pass through county and city jails in the United States, and most return to their communities within a few days or weeks of arrest. In New York City, about 100,000 people return from city jails to their community each year. Most are released between 1 a.m. and 3 a.m. in the morning, a time when the Department of Correction buses are available and community opposition to ex-offenders on the street is low. They're given 2 subway tokens and dropped at Queens Plaza, a busy subway stop that's also a center for drug trafficking and prostitution. As you might expect, few drug treatment or social service agencies are open at 1 in the morning, so many newly released inmates return to the people and places where they got arrested. And not surprisingly, more than 60% are rearrested within a year. And it's worth mentioning that it costs about $60,000 a year to lock someone up in the New York City jails. Nationally, about 4/5 of those leaving correctional facilities have a drug or alcohol problem. Many are at risk of HIV infection, and a substantial portion have serious mental health problems. Many are previous victims and or perpetrators of violence. Ted Hammett at Apt Associates has estimated that 1/4 of all HIV infection, 1/4 of all people with HIV infection, and 1/3 of those with tuberculosis have been released from prison or jail in the last year. Just staggering numbers. Yet most inmates are released without having received substance abuse treatment or significant discharge planning or aftercare. Few are linked to needed health services or connected to the social networks that could help them become productive members of their communities. And the public health and social consequences of not paying attention to this particular disparity-enhancing process is a further deterioration in the health of those individuals, their families, and a deterioration in community health and public safety, as well as increasing costs. And my colleagues and I, for the last 10 years, have been developing an intervention working at the individual, the community, and the policy level to reintegrate people into their communities and to assist people to assist community organizations to welcome instead of shun people who are coming from jail, thereby reducing their level of substance abuse, their HIV risk behavior, and their likelihood of being arrested. Preliminary studies have shown a significant, a 21% decline in rearrest rates for our population, and we're now finishing a randomized trial of this intervention. And we're looking, if you would go to the next one, to some questions about how do we take the results of this intervention and apply it to policy and to replication so that, again, this disparity-enhancing process can be reversed or at least slowed down, both in New York and in other urban areas. In summary, a variety of social processes work to magnify the health disparities that now characterize urban populations in the United States. By studying the specific dynamics of these processes and designing interventions to reverse this amplification, we may be able to contribute to improved health. The construction of interventions that undercut the production of inequalities in health, what I call disparity busters, is an important public health priority. The third line of research, which I just want to describe briefly, is to find new ways to synthesize our existing knowledge on the benefits of intervention. In the 21st century, the primary problem for scientific researchers will not be too little information, but too much unusable and poorly organized information. The current approach to developing evidence-based guidelines for practices usually involves formal review of those studies that meet the highest standards of clinical research, the gold standard being the randomized trial. Those findings that hold up across many studies or that yield significant results when data are pooled and subjected to meta-analytic procedures are considered worthy of dissemination. While there'll always be a place for this process in public health research, in my view, this traditional approach presents several problems when it comes to making valid generalizations that will enable us to reduce health disparities, especially in complex settings such as urban communities. Next slide. And one more. Some of the weaknesses include inadequate description of the population setting or context in which the results are achieved, the difficulty of controlling for numerous variables that affect health disparities in different studies, and limited attention to characterizing the intervention specifically enough to allow replication. And any of us who do interventions know how frustrating it is to see a successful intervention, but not to be able to understand the heart and soul of it in order to be able to replicate. The difficulty of combining studies that work at different levels of analysis or cut across disciplines in different ways, and the lack of comprehensive social science theories that allow integration of findings from different levels. As a result of these limitations, the findings from formal literature synthesis projects often produced mixed or superficial results, and we're going to need to find a better way to learn from our experience if we're going to be able to achieve our 2010 objectives of eliminating racial disparities. Some of the specific strategies we might want to take, if you could go to the next one, is to look, these are three different approaches to improving urban health. And we need to find new ways of understanding what are the unique contributions that each of these strategies can produce, and how do we best combine interventions that use these three approaches. And the next slide. And a few suggestions on how we can do that. One is we need to get a wider body of people together, such as the people represented in this room, not only researchers, but also practitioners, service providers, policymakers, advocates, community residents, to look not only at the literature that's in the peer-reviewed journals, but also at the experience of practitioners and community folks, and look for some systematic ways of synthesizing this experience and making recommendations that can guide the development of multi-level interventions. We need to develop new standards for reporting on our work, particularly in interventions where we include enough information about interventions that other people can benefit from them. We need to consider new ways to encourage the dissemination of interventions of proven efficacy. And I'm skeptical that the current approach of relying on manuals in order to replicate is very effective in both achieving fidelity and getting the efficiencies of scale. And I would suggest an approach where we much more focus on program principles and philosophy and look for ways to share those across settings and help people to implement those principles. And the final suggestion is to support more research on the organizational and political factors that facilitate or block implementation of interventions. Much of what we need to know to reduce health disparities, we already know. Not everything, but a lot we know. And the challenge we face is getting what we know into the field with enough intensity and duration and commitment to be able to see it make a difference. Reducing the health disparities that characterize U.S. cities and their surrounding metropolitan areas is the public health challenge of this century. It's both a scientific and a political venture. And those who are committed to eliminating disparities will need to move on both the scientific and the political front. But to avoid undue pessimism, I want to remind us of a few facts. We live in the richest country in the world after the longest period of prosperity in our history. Local, state, and national governments have record surpluses. Many U.S. cities have experienced improvements in health in the last few years after decades of decline. We have a strong public health system in many cities and a long tradition of addressing the social conditions that threaten health. Almost every urban neighborhood is blessed by a wealth of organizations and individuals who are dedicated to improving living conditions. What better place than here, and what better time than now, to join together to create cities that will ensure health for all of us. Thank you.
That was great. We still have fun.